It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And we have no Jeffrey again.
Nope, he's off. He's working hard. I talked with him briefly today, and he's hammering frantically away at his program that's coming up.
And we are so happy that one of us is gainfully working on something.
Yeah, exactly. He feels very passionate about it. You can tell when you talk to him. So
in honor of Jeffrey and Michael, since they are always, you know, with scotch or tequila, I have to announce that tonight I am drinking Stone Levitation.
Ooh, and I'm drinking Kool-Aid.
Oh, that's tasty. So,
well, since Jeffrey's not here, I'm going to read. I'll be the date guy today. And this comes out of the B5 chronology, and actually on August 12th, 2260, which is today, but 2009, mentions Delenn receives her letter from Valen and is upset by its contents. She also receives additional data from Drawl on Epsilon 3 and learns that he is using energy from the Great Machine to enlarge the temporal rift in Sector 14.
See, those stray tachyons never, ever, ever just play nice with others.
No, they don't. No, they don't. But there's your exciting date for today and a future that might be. Hey, got a couple of one other thing here to share. This is comes off of the JMS news group. And Poster asked, he says, a long time ago I heard that the CGI files of B5 are missing, and that's why it can't be converted to high resolution. My assumption was that they had been accidentally erased or destroyed or something. But somewhere online I read a message from someone who said something to the effect that Warner Brothers has massive archives and it's possible that they're still there somewhere, perhaps misplaced in some forgotten corner on zip drives or something. Does anyone think that's possible, or is that just wishful thinking? Hmm. Well, JMS responds, doesn't matter if any of them exist, they could never be upgraded to HD or anything close to that. They were produced on antiquated equipment at a resolution that's ridiculous in comparison to what's currently being done now. And honestly, what you'd pay to try and fail at up-resing them would be nearly what you'd pay to render everything fresh. So that might be cool. What if we get a B5 remastered?
That could be fun.
I've been watching some of the Star Trek remastered stuff, and after unclenching my Trekkie sphincter a little bit, I've actually been really enjoying what they've done with it.
And you know what? I would actually consider shelling out for all 5 seasons and Crusade and the movies if they
again.
If they came out in a high def format, mostly because my cases are falling apart.
Yeah, so if you're gonna have to buy them again, you might as well get something that's at a higher.
Exactly.
Just high resolution, yeah.
Instead of buying the same old cases all over again that'll fall apart in 5 years of, you know, constant rewatching, you know, get us some remastered cases along with the remastered content. That's funny. The original CGI was done at ridiculous resolution that cannot be upgraded at all.
Well, and for the time it was at the highest resolution they could do. And I do remember, I don't know if it was in one of the extras that was on The Lost Tales, or if I read this in one of the articles that came out at the time, but I recall reading or hearing something that when it came time to do the CG especially the space battle that Sheridan dreams about, that they grabbed files that fans had created of the various ships. And, you know, and they were just, I don't want to say amateurish, because that sounds, you know, denigrating. They were obviously got the best they could. But JMS's comment was that what fans were doing at a hobbyist level was at the same resolution that they were doing at a professional level when they originally did the show.
Wow.
And that was just, you know, again, one of those, you know, time marches on and advances are made. So
does that mean that they can take the framework that was rendered before and just re-render them in new, you know, with new artwork, new software, or would they have to be redesigned from scratch too, like shot for shot for shot?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether they'd be able to take those original meshes and bring them forward, if you will, you know, use those as a basis and add to them, or if they would have to start completely from scratch, because I don't know anything about, you know, other than the fact that they were done on, you know, Amiga toasters. I don't know what packages were used to actually create the models.
Sounds like we need to reach out to the several different groups of graphics people and say, hey, what would you do?
Well, I keep pinging Mojo. He shows up in Gmail, you know, the little thing there where the dot turns green to say, hey, I'm online. Mm-hmm. And I always just like, hey, Babylon Podcast, would you be on the show with us? And he never really responds, but I figure, you know, this,
reach out.
Nothing to lose. Yeah, right, exactly.
That's what we should do. We should invite or send out a questionnaire to people from Foundation and Netter Digital and say, hey, what do you need to re-render the graphics at higher resolutions? Do you just upgrade what you have, or do you have to start all over? Tell us. We're curious.
All right.
Yeah, just what I needed. Another project on my to-do list.
I know.
Track down graphics people and...
shake them violently.
No, that's all I've got for now.
All right.
My other secret project is proceeding nicely.
Ooh.
Yes, I actually hope to tell people about it soon. Yes, it is Babylon 5 related. Yes, it is a project that's near and dear to my heart, but a hell of a lot more work than I initially anticipated.
Are you creating Jason Carter, a high-res model?
No.
Okay.
All right. But other than that, I got nothing.
Okay. Well, I think that's good. I think why don't we take a break and we'll just go ahead and start doing some deep geeking.
I'm Michael R. Menengay.
I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Michael Stackpole.
And I'm Brian Brown.
Join us for an exciting romp through literature and books.
Romp?
We're not romping.
We're supposed to be cool.
That's smooth. Right.
Okay.
It's the cool.
It's the smoothing sounds.
I don't know, but romp just brings forth images of Michael in tights, and I'm so not going there.
Well, which Michael?
It doesn't matter. Neither one would be very good.
If you would like to join this thing that we do every week, it's called Dragon Page, cover to cover.
Take two. Welcome to Dragon Page, cover to cover, where the elite meet to discuss literature.
Okay, let's go back to the tight two and just... Yeah.
Dragon Page, cover to cover, where you'll never know what you're going to get next.
Digging down into the most obscure facts and fandom, this is
Deep Geeking.
Yeah.
This week we delve deeper into the conflict of the telepaths. The tragedy of the telepaths, you might actually say.
I love that title, by the way.
It is.
Very evocative.
I trying to remember what other thing is like, you know, you have like a gaggle of geese, a flock of this, a pride of lions, a tragedy of something. I know there's another word out there that that actually fits, but I never know what it is.
They give murder of crows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That one too.
Right.
But other than that, yes, we have, we step from drama into straight out tragedy. And there's no good can come once you cross that line.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I did note, and with Lockley's captain's log of exposition at the beginning, something that I noted reading last week on Lurker's Guide, that, make the long story short, this show aired nearly a month or two after Kingdom of the Blind, because TNT was running NBA playoffs.
Oh.
So that's why her captain's log sounds like our story so far.
You know, I never put that together. I just thought they had experimented with a season break. You know how you get the season breaks in the UK? Mm-hmm. I thought they had done one of those, and it was a catch-up for them, and so what if it sounds a little wild for the U.S. crowd?
Nope. It's completely based on TNT. And the other thing was that apparently, in terms of what was originally planned for running, Day of the Dead was going to come a couple episodes after Tragedy of Telepaths, but right, it was determined to run that first because basically with a month or two off for basketball playoffs, they felt that it would be better to get into it and really ramp up the drama of it rather than start to ramp up the drama and then drop that episode in and break up some of the momentum that you want to keep going. So,
and it actually makes sense to have Day of the Dead first because you have this break in the momentum at a period where it's not so critical. If you were to have that later, like right in the middle of all of this, how would the staff and the ambassadors have time to deal, you know, with this festival when you've got armed telepaths fighting each other in the hallways? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, right. Well, we had a colony of telepaths set fire to themselves. Oh, hey, by the way, we're having Rebo and Zooty show up for the eulogy. You know, in that light, it's almost like Soulmates, which was, I don't want to say a lighter episode, but it was, you know, there was more humor to that in that same way that, you know, if you had played Soulmates later on in the second season, I think you would have really, it would have been a jarring juxtaposition to stuff that was going on then. So I think that's one of those that, you know, worked out for the best.
Right.
One of those switches. Because this is one of those, as Lockley comments at the end of the episode, this is very much the calm before the storm. You know, this is the final arranging of the pieces. And go ahead.
No, I'm saying final arranging of the pieces. It's like she knows it's going to end badly, or she's expecting it to end badly and hopes she'll be pleasantly surprised otherwise.
Yeah, I don't think she even has hope. I think that's the thing about it at the end is she's, you know, tomorrow, you know, there's going to be bodies on the deck. There's no, you know, that's the thing that strikes me, the difference between her and Sheridan. Sheridan still at the 11th hour is looking for some way to get out of this peacefully. Lockley is, I don't want to say more of a realist, maybe a little more pragmatic.
Yeah.
But her outlook is she just knows this is going to end badly. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, and there's actually a complementary point of view between her assessment of the telepath situation and Garibaldi's statement of, you know, we're the next big thing. People want to try to knock it down.
Yeah, right.
And I thought that was interesting. I'm like, okay, you've got the pessimistic pragmatist telling you what you need to hear but don't necessarily want to hear. Nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the whole scene where Lockley's crawling down into the bowels of the ship to of the station to get to where Byron is, just so Byron can say goodbye face to face.
Yeah,
I thought her going down there to try to talk them out was good. I thought mm-hmm. Byron's reasoning, no, I just want to say goodbye, was
yeah
weak.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
To not even listen to her when, you know, he's said all along, you know, you haven't been for us, you haven't been against us, you've been fair. To not even listen to her suggestions as a way to try to get, it seems like he's almost made up his mind. Okay, we're all going to, you know, we're going to die here and make a point. It's like he's not even trying to keep his people alive. Because his people right now are the bulk of the free telepaths who are in this movement to try to set things right, to get a home for themselves, to resist Psi-Corps peacefully. If
right.
most of them die, who's picking up that torch?
Oh, well, we know who ends up picking up the torch. It's all the ones who were smart enough to get out and escape. And
no. Those the ones who got out of his little sit-in there are the ones who tend towards violence.
Right, exactly.
All of the peaceful ones were the ones yeah. who were trapped in there with him. He had to have known that by rejecting Lockley's last offer, that any hope for a peaceful turnover was gone. And that he's condemning his own people to be symbols instead of active, I don't know.
Well, see, but again, to me, this is one of the reasons why I like the Byron character. There's those kinds of complexities. He is such an idealist that it blinds him to the reality of the situation. And even, you know, as we talked about last week, when his resolve breaks a little bit to the point where, you know, his pie in the sky vision is corrupted by the anger he feels for what happened, he still tries to drag it back up to that idealism. And that's his fatal flaw. That's the tragedy of the character. It, to me, he isn't open to hearing other ways of doing things. To him, he is so convinced that the way to get what they want is to do it his way, that there is no budging him. You know the phrase convictions make for convicts, and that's the situation here. He's basically in the prison of his own convictions.
And that's fine. He's making a martyr out of himself, but the fact that he took all those other people with him without giving them a say-so or letting, you know, they, I don't know.
Well,
is that,
see, I always get the sense that they were there of their own accord. That was the thing, you know, when Lockley said, okay, you know, you want to stay here, that's fine, but how about the rest of you? And they all just look at her. Again, there's one of the things that's going on there is that telepathic thing, okay? So previously, Byron told the group, look, you know, I've got no hold on you. If you want to go, go. And a smattering
right.
of them did.
But
so,
why didn't he say it again there? Why didn't... Because they don't trust her, but he does. He could have said, if anyone truly wants to leave, you can go with her now.
He doesn't trust her either. That was the point, is he said, you've never really been supportive of us, but you have been fair.
Then
and
why,
there's a difference.
Why bother calling her down there just to say goodbye? It doesn't quite fit.
Because that's part of his makeup. That's he wants, Byron wants so badly for the playing field to be level. Okay. We deserve a home world of our own because we were cannon fodder for your war. That's fair in his mm-hmm. mind. Okay. What else is fair? All right. President Sheridan, you've given us sanctuary to live on the station, so in return, we'll gather intelligence for you. That's fair. And I think that's what Byron's whole point is, that he wants to get that message out, and that's part of the message, is that Lockley will go back and say, all right, well, I talked with Byron, he wouldn't budge, but this is what he said. So that maybe on some level he knows, you know, the vast majority of human population anyways views telepaths at best freaks, you know, and at worst they are murderously dangerous. So I think that he knows it's going to end badly. He wants at least that segment, that little bit of it out there to say, we recognize when someone's being fair to us. And so, like he said, he just says it needed to be commented on.
He could have recorded a data crystal and given it to Lita.
Well, Lita didn't show any signs of getting out.
But he sent her away later anyway. You knew he was not going to let her sacrifice herself. You knew that.
Right. But again, that's, you know, again, to me, the part of the tragic flaw of the character.
I suppose. There's just so many. There's so much good about the flaws of this character, and every now and then there's just that one little note that rings a little false. I'm like, oh, he wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, but see, again, I think he would have. That's why it doesn't bother me. I think you know that's just how I stand. And the thing that I like is I look. How do I want to say this? Hand in hand with that is I like what this shows about Lockley's character, is that she goes into a dangerous situation, but she has, you know, whether it's something that was kind of planted there. Again, I don't think I think she knows they were sending a message, but not trying to manipulate her in the same way that they did the welder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think she is. That's the fairness of that character. Look, they're holed up in there. We got to dig them out. I just got a message that said, come talk to me. Okay, well, my instinct tells me they don't really mean me harm because I'm not freaking out like the welder, because if they really wanted to hurt me, they could have done X, Y, or Z. And so she has no qualms about going in there. You know, and when Zach holds out the PBG for her, she's like, you know, there's so many of them, it wouldn't make a difference.
You know. Yeah, and I'm fine with that. I wonder if when they were talking, if Byron sensed or picked up any thought that she had already called in Bester, because the way that was worded, I need your help. Come on, you know, come on back. You know, that was the plea of someone. You know, I'm at my wit's end. I don't know what to do with this situation. I know you do. I may not like it, but, you know, you're my only hope, Obi Bester.
Yes. Oh, and I love, you know, the one little nonverbal, the way she is, her fingers are twitching as she makes that call. You know, yeah. She's rubbing her thumb together and she's flexing her fingers. And the whole time I'm watching that going, yeah, she's.
She doesn't want to make that like, call. But yeah. She knows she doesn't have, you know, her she's out of other options by now. You know, this is right. Her last option. She's got to make the call.
Right. And the fact of the matter is she makes the call. You know, I thought this was the one thing that was interesting, was she makes the call, goes down to check on the situation, gets invited in by Byron, but at no point does she say Bester and the Bloodhounds are a day and a half away.
No, she doesn't.
And, you know, she just says, now's your last chance. Come on out or else, you know, there's going to be bodies on the floor. And I'm guessing she's guessing that they probably got that figured out, that Bester's on the way. And when Bester shows up, oh, my God, what an oily guy.
And the Cheshire Cat grin on his face. For most of the entire time.
Yes. I knew they'd be calling me back. I just knew you'd be calling me.
He's like, yeah, I don't want to say I told you so, but I told you so.
Oh, he didn't even say it. It wasn't even, I don't want to, but I told you. Mm-hmm. You know, Lockley yeah. says, oh, I let you know. They told you there'd be trouble. Oh, well. You didn't listen. I mean, it was just like that. You didn't listen. And his interaction with Zach was perfect. We got two people down. No, those are your people. My He's people like, are in there.
I clean up my mess. You clean up yours. These aren't mine. Later.
Yeah.
The callousness of it was spot on. He's like, yeah, these aren't mine. What do I care?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what gets Zach more than anything is that Zach is the guy. He's that everyman who, no matter, you know, you might stand on the wrong side of the law in his eyes, but you're still a person. Okay. And that's what is at the basis of it for him. And Bester sees the division so much more clearly. It isn't, you know, we're human beings and some can do things that others can't. It's like telepaths is a whole separate species from Homo erectus. And
and his whole being, actually, as we, you know, we find out from when he was younger, that's been his way. We are different from them. We are better than them. Eventually, we will be the ones in control. We have to remember that it's not human beings here. We're talking mundanes and telepaths. Right. And he sees that very, very clear line. And that's what makes what comes up in the next couple of episodes so profound. Yeah. And that I love.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like all the pieces in place, the group, the rogue telepaths who get weapons, fall so easily into the patterns of violence. It's like, you know, it takes him a moment. It's like, but Byron, you know, he wouldn't like this, but the one guy's like, no, you don't get it. Byron wouldn't like it, but he's got no other options. So we've got to do this for him because he won't. I know where he can get weapons. And then after that, it's like, it's just bloodlust.
Right. Now I have to ask, were those fighter pilots that they took out, or were those weren't security guys?
I thought they were fighter pilots.
Because I have friends who are Marines and Rangers who would just start really, really ragging on flyboys. If that's the case. Because I'm sitting there going, you know what? No self-respecting space Marine would get taken out like that. I'm sorry. Right. That doesn't happen.
No, I thought they were pilots.
Okay. If somebody can rerun that and like slow it down and get some insignia off those uniforms and confirm for us whether those were Marines or flyboys, that would help. But yeah, I was a little disappointed by that. Like, come on, you can put up a better fight than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But other than that, yeah, it's the escalation driven by fear and rage.
Right. And speaking of escalations driven by fear and rage, we get the Drazi and the Bracciri and the game all pointing fingers at each other. Sheridan's, you touched on it earlier with Garibaldi's pragmatic cynicism, you know, what's going on. But poor Sheridan, I mean, you could really feel the bewilderment. He's like, I just don't get it. You know, and it isn't that kind of a, you know, saying I don't get it, but really getting it. It's just like he just doesn't. We're trying to put something together here that helps everybody. And why does everyone still insist on going their own way?
It's more than that. He doesn't understand why they are so quick to jump on an obvious trick. I mean, we've seen in the past where other races have, well, not quite to the extent of our own human experience, but how can they not realize that they're being played at all?
Well, I think the thing is they don't know that they're being played because they don't have all the information. That's the one thing. Again, if you're looking at tragic flaws, and this really struck me this time watching it, even though John and Delenn are about the good of the whole, the fact of the matter is they still deal with themselves. Oh, they said it in Kingdom of the Blind. We're going to deal with this first in-house. Well, what does that mean? That means we've got our own little inner circle that's working on this problem. And constantly, as they're talking about this issue, they're asking, just give us time. You know, it was almost a contradiction. And again, I don't think this is bad writing or not ringing true characters. It's just like you just go, if you guys could only hear what you're saying when they say, you know, we all have to stand together to solve this. We'll figure it out. Just give us a little more time, mm-hmm. which means we're gathering the information. When we're ready, we will give you all the stuff that we know. But right. It's like,
yeah, that's, you know, okay. Yeah, I see that. What should have happened was send us one investigator from each of your races to help us track down all of these leads.
Right, exactly.
And they can report back to you. We'd like to keep some stuff under wraps because we don't know which pieces might tip our tip hand off, to the people responsible, but at least you'll have a person in there with us at the higher level of at the alliance level, and you know, helping us track down all these leads. And that's what they should have been using the Rangers for to begin with. We should have seen more Ranger traffic. You know, Rangers going out investigating sites. Why didn't the Rangers investigate those attacks first? It's like nobody's asked them. You know, it's like, hey, you know, can we get some Rangers over here to, you know, help with this? You know, help, you know, can we get a Ranger escort for this one particular shipment right here?
Are you talking about why aren't the Drazi or the Bracciri or any of the member alliance members asking for that? Or are you saying, you know, why isn't Sheridan saying, look, there's a Bracciri convoy heading out. We're going to put two white stars on them to tail it and see what's going on.
I thought I'm it was sure. The Rangers could only enforce the peace along the borders. They couldn't actually go into alliance space unless in response to a request for help or an aggressive act.
Right. Well, and then maybe that's it. Maybe that's why we're not seeing that kind of Ranger traffic.
What I'm saying is that I would have thought that would have been the first people you asked help for help for. Our shipping lines are being attacked. We need to know who's going to do it. We're blaming the Drazi for it. Instead, our shipping lanes are being attacked. Can we get some Ranger help over here?
But I think, again, that gets back to those old ways of thinking, those old patterns. We want to be part of the alliance, but nobody's going to tell us what to do. I mean, that's very much what the Drazi's stance is. It's our shipping that's being attacked by the Bracciri, and we're going to take care of it. And you can't do anything about it because it's an internal matter. You know, it's only toward the end of the episode when Sheridan reveals that, basically, you know, says we've got White Stars watching the whole bunch of you.
If they start
kind of playing along.
Mm-hmm. I only think it would have been an internal matter if only one race were being attacked. If only one race were being attacked, then yeah, it's internal. But we've had attacks on everybody, so that's an alliance-wide problem.
Right, but they don't know that until Sheridan says that. And that's the thing. That gets back to that whole thing of the transparent nature of things. They're sitting there. John and Delenn are sitting on this intelligence trying to gather more information so that they can basically, as far as I can see, present the problem and the solution simultaneously. Because, you know, their experience has been that if you just bring the problem there, bad stuff happens. Well, if you don't bring the problem there, bad stuff happens. You know, and that's the thing. That when, again, the reaction, if you think about the reaction of the Drazi and the Bracciri, but the Drazi especially, when, you know, it wasn't that they're looking for help from the Rangers. They're basically saying, as far as we know, it is an internal matter. And when Sheridan says, no, it's everybody, you're all being played, that's back more toward the end. And he's saying part of what we're going to do to make sure you guys don't do anything stupid is we're all going to keep an eye on the lot of you. And rather than that response, like, okay, at least we'll know we'll be protected, the response is,
you're preventing me from going and kicking sand back in the face of the people we think are responsible for this.
Right, exactly. And we'll play it your way for now.
Yeah.
But, you know, as the Drazi says, you know, every great fall begins with one step, and you've just made yours.
Mm. And that was a little over-aggressive, I think.
Oh, I thought it was perfect Drazi. Yeah. I really did. It's just obnoxious and belligerent, and, and, you know, it's just like, and part of it was to say, you know, you are not in charge of us. You know, it was the Bracciri, you know, he objects when the ships show up. It's like, you know, you can't do that. And Sheridan goes, nope, go read the Constitution. That's not what we signed up for. No, I'm sure it wasn't what you signed up for. And I think that was the one moment that Sheridan got a little bit of joy out of the situation, was sticking it back to him. No, this isn't what you thought it was going to be at all. But again, like you said, you know, they still didn't invite anybody in on the investigation. They just said, well, you know, give us some more time. We'll have answers for you. It's like,
At least tell them, hey, we are running an investigation. You know, we have people out gathering information. As soon as we have something concrete that we can prove to tell you, we will.
Right. Or we will give you reports weekly to let you know what the status is. Something. Some measure of transparency, and it wasn't there.
Throw the angry ones a bone.
Yeah, or they will be chewing on yours.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then speaking of chewing, there's your segue. How about the spoo?
Fresh spoo. It's a sacrilege. Yes. Everyone knows that spoo has to be properly aged.
That's right. Yeah. And I loved how that little bit was Jakar leaned onto it immediately. Wait a minute, I'm the only Narn here, why is there fresh spoo? And it took Londo a moment, you know, it's like, what's back there? Well, you know, old living quarters, nobody's there anymore. And then, you know, it's this wing, and then you can just see it in his face. Oh, there's underground cells.
Like, uh-oh. Fresh spoo, south wing. There's more Narns down there. Oh, yeah. Man.
Yeah. And the evolution of the relationship between Jakar and Londo continued. And I Londo finally rose to that challenge when, you remember when Jakar in the very long night of Londo Malari, he berates him. You had an obligation to speak out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you couldn't, you know, Londo's protests, I couldn't make a difference. Like, that doesn't matter whether you could have made a difference or not. Well, it's as though Londo is taking that opportunity, even when he says, I don't know what I can do about this, and he's laying out all the legal ramifications. I'm the prime minister, and I can't go against the regent, and, you know, only the emperor can countermand the order, blah, 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 and Jakar's just having none of it.
Mm-hmm.
And Londo rises to the occasion.
And, of course, it was inspired by a lovely female.
You know, that was – I'm watching that scene, and I'm thinking about – it for whatever reason, it just suddenly popped into my head. Battlestar Galactica had no scenes like that. It was just so unrelentingly bleak. And Babylon 5, as – dire as the situation's getting, you like Lockley says, there's going to be bodies on the floor. Okay, Londo is running the risk of discovery, sneaking this Narn out against all decrees, and there's a, you know, royal hierarchy he's got to follow, blah, blah, blah. That bit with the woman that comes in is like, can I borrow your clothes? Oh, Emperor Cartesia played this game too, but you're not my size. I mean, it was just like, and Jakar's that, you know, when...
Yeah. The whole scene where he says, I need your dress, but you don't have to undress in front of the,
plop.
Oh, okay.
Right.
And the look on Jakar's face was like, okay.
Right. Yeah, animal magnetism, what can I say?
Yeah, the nonchalant way she said, oh yes, Emperor Cartesia used to play this game for me, but you're not my size.
Yeah, right,
like, oh, okay, you do that too, no problem, here.
Yeah, it's just part of life in the royal court.
Yeah, and as for Galactica being too bleak, I slightly disagree, because there's some stuff in season one and season two where Baltar is caught having sex with Invisible Six that are just funny.
Yeah, I know. That was a little unfair on my part, but...
But yeah, point taken.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole thing will be invisible by being loud and obnoxious and noticeable was actually very funny.
Yes.
If you're trying to sneak out, trying to avoid detection, you'll get caught. But if you're trying to be loud and obnoxious, people will ignore you because it's...
It's part of their training.
It's a lack of decorum.
Right. You know? Yeah, and the close-ups of the faces, the reaction shots are great. You know, the guard is like pulling his little helmet down so he doesn't have to look. Mm-hmm. It was... And then the end when they see the toss transport away. And it's a nice little intimate scene with Londo and Jakar. And, you know, Jakar is obviously very concerned about Natoth, and he knows, you know, there's great healing to be done for her. She's really not out of the woods yet on a spiritual level, which is where Jakar is. And Londo, it is like the twilight of his character. I will tell you a true thing, Jakar. And it's just like, he doesn't have many more moments like that left in his life, and it really is sad.
Yeah. It's like he knows that he's not going to have many chances to have that kind of off-the-cuff fun once he becomes emperor. So having another adventure... I mean, the last time we saw him have that adventure was Voice in the Wilderness, right? Where he's like,
yes.
Yeah. Landing thrusters. if I were a landing thruster, where would I be? Oh, here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the end, we have Bester.
Yes.
Welcoming his bloodhound units on. And, you know, it's not going to end well.
And you know what? It all started off so nicely, too.
So what do you think about the bookends of Lockley's personal log, opening with the personal log, ending with a personal log?
Well, I like it. I thought it was a nice way to, even given the expository nature of the open, I like it because really, in a sense, she is the one that unfortunately has to be there to clean up the mess because it's on her watch. You know, she didn't want the telepath there, but President Sheridan granted them sanctuary. Okay. They got out of control. Well, you know what? Bester's going to show up to take over it, and she doesn't really want that either, but what can she do about it? So it really is almost the person who has, you know, in a sense, she's the one individual in this that has no stake in the situation, except for the fact that it's her watch. And so I liked having her be that bookend. You know, she's the one that it does, you know, Bester, despite the fact that they're his telepaths, he's not above making examples of those if they need to be made examples of. Okay, we've seen that before. It will pain him, but you can't make an egg without, or make an omelet without breaking eggs, right? Zach is, you know, he wants order on the station, but he doesn't want to have to go to get into gunfights over it. Okay, so he's mad about that whole situation because he feels like he's getting caught in between, but, you know, the telepaths have pushed it. You know, Sheridan, he's just trying to do the right thing, you know, and it's going to be a black eye for the Alliance when this situation ends tragically, because it's part of what's fueling the animosity going on in the Alliance chambers with the mysterious attacks on the shipping lines. Okay, so all these people are deeply embroiled in the situation, except for on an emotional level, I guess I should say, except for Lockley. And so, yeah, I thought it was good to have her just, you know, okay, it all starts tomorrow. Body's on the floor.
And so it almost ends.
It's the end, or is it just the beginning?
The end of one chapter, the beginning of another one that we don't actually get to see on TV. Darn it.
Oh, we got hints of it in Path of Sorrow. Is that the Crusade episode where we get a little bit of Matheson's story? Yeah, he was there on. Great. Yeah.
Get a hint of it, but not the full, juicy, delicious 72-ounce steak that would have been the telepath war.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't even get novels of it.
Alas.
You know, that thing would, they couldn't keep that on the shelves.
Mm-mm. I wonder if there's someone at Warner Brothers we could, like, talk to and say, hey, you know, if someone were to submit to you a proposal for a Telepath War trilogy that had JMS's blessing, would you at least print the thing, promote it a little bit? Yeah. Oh, let us promote it for you. We can do that.
Right, exactly. All we want is free copies.
Yeah, we'll do free copies. Just let us put the damn thing out there. Yeah. All right.
Thanks for that, Summer. Thanks.
No problem. I throw that out there in the hopes that someone with enough clout can help us instigate that little thing. Because, you know, in the grand realm of instigations, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I agree.
I'm with you.
Did we cover everything, or do we need to let Gary call in a voicemail later and tell us?
That will never stop Gary from calling in, so that's a given.
Right. Well,
no, but I think we covered it.
All right, that will end it for our deep geeking this week. We will take a really quick break and come back with a few voicemail messages.
Yeah.
From the creators of Buffy Between the Lines Studios presents a new masterpiece in audio drama. This fall, in L.A., hell will break loose. The City of Angels cries out for help. Who will answer this call?
Angel Investigations. We help the helpless. What can we do for you?
An original fan production based in Joss Whedon's universe. A vampire with a soul and his fellow champions will face threats as never witnessed before. Get ready for this action-packed podcast that will blow your mind. Angel Between the Lines. Visit us at angelbetweenthelines.com.
Voicemail, voicemail, voicemail. The thing that keeps us going and keeps us entertained by your thoughts and reminding us of stuff that we forgot and sometimes non sequiturs that make no sense but still are entertaining.
Well, actually, we've got emails today. We don't have the voicemails, but nonetheless, very, very important. So we've got a few here we want to clean up. First one, this comes to us from Vlad DeRosa. He writes to us, I was watching Avatar on Nicktoons with my boys tonight and heard an interesting line. Uncle Iroh to Zuko, it is time to start asking yourself the big questions. Who are you and what do you want?
I remember that episode.
I've watched Avatar off and on with my kids, but I missed this episode.
That's the episode, I'm drawing a blank on the name, but it's the episode where they have broken into the Dai Li's secret headquarters under Lake Laogai in Ba Sing Se to free Appa. You have no idea what I'm talking about, do you?
Exactly, right. I don't. Like I said, I only watched a handful of episodes, and they weren't in any particular, stringing them together. It was just, okay, wandering in the room. Hey, okay, I'll send a while. I mean, I enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong. I didn't think it was stupid or anything.
It's in Earth, which is book two, and it's the episode before the episode called The Earth King. So that's where it is. And it's really, really cool.
Okay, next one. Sorry?
I said, there's a lot of cool stuff in that series. You should check it out.
Yeah, I will. It's just a question of time. All right, this comes to us from Mike Tuck. You guys were talking about Corwin's actual rank on the podcast and seemed unsure of it, so I will throw this in for whatever it's worth. Even though he didn't get to do much in Season 5, it appears that he was second in command. I don't remember them actually saying that on the show, but I have all of the B5 novels, including A Call to Arms. In that novel, Corwin is referred to as, quote, Lieutenant David Corwin, Lockley's second in command. End quote. I'm assuming that the novel is canon like the TV movie. Well, I think we knew, Summer, I think we knew what Corwin's rank was. I think we were just unsure as to what his status was in terms of the command structure.
Yeah, it's more of not a rank, but sort of, what do you do again?
Yeah, right, exactly. And I mean, we get to see him do so much more in Season 5 than we did in the 3 years leading up to this, but he's never making command decisions in the same way that Ivanova would make command decisions.
Right. That's the question of what his real role was.
Correct. Correct. So, you know, given that, my assumption was that he was basically, I mean, it says second in command, but I think it's more... What, adjutant? Is that the term?
Adjutant. I don't know.
You know that he's there to coordinate, but he's not there to make decisions.
Right. We actually don't get a whole lot of scenes in CNC where they're dealing with stuff in season five.
Right. It is much more elsewhere. You know, we still get to see Jakar Sack out in on the floor.
Yeah.
Bay. All right, here we go. You ready for the next one?
Sure.
This comes to us from Valerie Stewart. She writes, I just wanted to let you know that I was somewhat shocked to hear Tim and Michael's contributions to the discussion of West Virginia Day. This was actually some time ago, but she goes on to write, crude stereotypes and bigotry don't become you. The day, by the way, is the anniversary of the day West Virginia was recognized as a separate state after breaking away from Virginia when the state government in Richmond decided to join the Confederacy. I think that was about Juneteenth. She finishes to say, oh, well, better the cheap laugh, right? Still listening sometimes in Maryland. Well, Valerie, I apologize. I can't speak for Michael. You know, what can we say? We went for the cheap laugh and it was, you know, if anything, you know what? I'm not even going to say anything more. I'll be shoving more foot down my throat. So my sincere apologies, believe me, it wasn't out of any, you know, malice. It was just being stupid. So there.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Ready for this last one here? This comes to us from David and Augusta. Hello, Babylon 5. Thanks for doing the podcast. I was wondering about atheism in sci-fi in general, and in Babylon 5 in particular. I think JMS is a free thinker, and to me the Babylon 5 story has a secular humanist perspective, much like Star Trek. Someone, I can't remember who, once said an advanced enough technology is indistinguishable from magic, a la the Shadows and Vorlons using their technology to be the basis of religions. Something like that could be true, or religion could have just been a way to get set guidelines within a community. Don't do this, don't do that, etc. What do you guys think? Are any of you three free thinkers? Take care, David and Augusta. Well, Summer, do you want to handle that light, fluffy topic?
I think atheism isn't the right word. Most people I know are actually agnostic. It's like, okay, whatever's out there is out there. I don't have any proof one way or another. It's not that there is no God, there's nothing out there. It's just, whatever will be, will be.
I just finished reading an essay in the Ben Bella Pop Smart book, Boarding the Enterprise, and the essay was about religion and Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And to paraphrase, basically boiled down to that Star Trek very much had the secular humanist perspective in that religion was treated at best with disdain and was portrayed as something by which masses were deluded into doing harmful things. And you know, without going into the cultural situation surrounding Star Trek in the mid-60s, you know, take that for what it is. That is, to me, one of the hallmarks of Babylon 5 is that where JMS does not espouse any particular religion, neither does he treat any particular religion with disrespect. I mean, someone who had a purely humanist, secular humanist perspective or was an atheist, okay, let's see, we use the word that David starts off with, would not have put Brother Theo on that station.
That's true.
You know, he wouldn't have treated Londo's invocation of the Great Maker with the respect that he did, or you know, the Minbari religious caste. And that to me, I think that's a harder line to walk than to either come out and say, you know, there is a God and everybody else is wrong, or to say there is no God and everybody else is wrong. Mm-hmm. To be able I even think in River of Souls, one of my favorite little scenes is the bit where Lockley and Garibaldi and Zach are discussing the nature of the soul hunters and what happens, and you know, the soul hunters are grabbing the souls, blah, blah, blah. And Zach just says, yeah, we're keeping them from going to heaven. And Lockley and Garibaldi look at him like he's just sprouted a second head.
Right.
You know? But, you know, and he just looks up and goes, what? So I believe in heaven. I mean, and the thing is, it makes perfect sense for the character. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not the guy who's going to go around with his, you know, I Heart Jesus bumper sticker, but you know, it makes sense that, yeah, I believe there's something else beyond there. And, you know, it was a perfect moment. And again, anybody who doesn't have that kind of open-mindedness about such stuff, I don't think would write characters like that.
Yeah. Very, very much someone who has studied a lot, read a lot about different beliefs, faiths, different approaches to having faith, and doesn't judge any of them.
Yeah.
And yeah. From my point of view, we need a hell of a lot more people like that.
Yeah, I've read a great quote. I can't remember which. He's a Western Buddhist teacher, but his comment was, you know, we don't need more Buddhists, we need more Buddhas. So, for what that's worth. So, yeah, good question, but
yeah, so it is.
Oh, and by the way, David, the quote, any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic, that is Arthur C. Clarke.
Okay, then, so when do we actually get real magic?
We already have it.
We do?
Tell me exactly how your cell phone works. See?
You mean it's not bouncing little electromagnetic waves through my brain?
Well, it is, but if something goes wrong with it, could you fix it?
I don't think anybody can actually fix the little electromagnetic waves. I mean, those are the little bits of magic. You know, once we can start grabbing them out of the air and being able to redirect them where we want without the little gizmos, then we'll be actually having magic. Just because we use it doesn't mean we can like do stuff with it yet.
Well, think about it in these terms. I mean, I was even thinking about this. My parents have their 50th wedding anniversary coming up.
And wow, congratulations.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that great? I'm really excited. Looking forward to going up for that. But even in that 50 years, and here's the thing. My dad, when I was born, we were in Huntsville, and he was working on software test firing boosters for the Saturn V. Okay? Big mammoth things. But, you know, at that point in time, it's landlines and all that kind of technology. Even then, even in science fiction, at that point in time, nobody wrote about television at the first lunar landing.
Hmm.
Okay, so that's even in the space of 10 years. So, you know, think of how and again, we know it's technology, so we know it's science and not quote-unquote magic. But the point being is that things move forward so quickly and things that change that in a sense, you know, we are living with magic. You know, my grandmother told me, she was a German immigrant. She told me, you know, the day an airplane flew over their village, everybody came out to look and see.
Wow.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's just so there you are.
Yep. Is it wrong or is it a bad thing that so many of us are so used to technology, we expect things to keep getting better and faster and, you know, all the tools to keep improving. We don't have a sense of wonder about the cool stuff anymore.
I think you've touched on two different things. I think it's not. I think it's good for us to expect new and better advances. I think the danger is that when we expect them and treat them as though they are, like you say, when we've lost that sense of wonder.
When we expect them to keep just, it's not a surprise anymore.
Right. Or that you just don't recognize what's gone into your Bluetooth headset. You know, that you don't stop and sit back and say, you know, this is amazing. 100 years ago, this would have been magic and probably gotten you burned at the stake or whatever. But like I said, about 300 or 400 years ago. But anyways, but the point being, yes, we do lose that sense of wonder. I mean, that's a topic we could go on forever. The latest issue of Discover came in and there's a cover article about a proposed mission to Europa. And I'm like, you know, why do we have to wait? Let's build that thing now.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long, long time before we're no longer fascinated by space travel. But, you know, the little simple things, we should be just going, literally, I looked at my iPod Touch the first time when I first got it and was just completely fascinated by, you know, the dragging things, like dragging my finger across the screen. And now, like, half the cell phones out there do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. I don't know. I'm well, somewhat...
It's easy for things to become mundane.
All right. Any more emails?
That will do it for tonight.
All righty then.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, you know the spot, BabylonPodcast.com. Come by the website, visit us, leave us some comments, join in the conversation over at the forums. That's farpointforums.com. Look for the little Babylon Podcast logo. If you want to send in your own emails, that email address is BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. Call in a voicemail. We do play them occasionally, and every now and then we actually have a Feedback-a-palooza show where we get through a lot of them. That number is, if you can call it when Gary's not on the line, 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year that technology indistinguishable from magic came upon us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.